and again this morning, our colleagues in the Democratic Republic of the Congo report heavy small arms fire and mortar fire across the city and the presence of many dead bodies in the streets. We have reports of rapes committed by fighters, looting of property, including of a humanitarian warehouse, and humanitarian and health facilities being hit. Hospitals in Goma are reportedly overwhelmed, struggling to manage the influx of wounded people. Electricity and water supplies are compromised, and yesterday internet services were cut off, and Goma is still offline this morning.
Earlier today, protests broke out in Kinshasa, the capital of the DRC, outside the embassies of several allies of Rwanda, including France and the United States. To talk more about the Congo, we're joined by Maurice Carney, co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo. Maurice, explain what's happening to a global audience in the DRC.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be with you. First and foremost, global audience have to understand that this is a part of a 30-year war of aggression and plunder by U.S. allies, Rwanda, led by Paul Kagame, and Uganda, led by Yoweri Museveni. And this war of aggression and plunder has been able to continue as a result of the support that they have received from major powers like the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, France. That's in part why you see in Kinshasa today, young people are rising up and protesting at those embassies, at the U.S. embassy, the Ugandan embassy, at the French embassy. And so this is has been ongoing for some time. And it's been ongoing as a result of really three factors, Amy. One is rampant impunity. The Rwandan leader, Paul Kagame, and Yoweri Museveni been able to work in eastern Congo, intervene with impunity. Second, there's been a lack of accountability. And third, there's been a lack of justice. Now, what we've seen over the last few days are flurries of activities on the part of the diplomatic representatives at the UN, at emergency session being called. You have France and the UK, United States, all making statements. And they, if you follow their statements, they all say Rwanda must leave. Rwandan soldiers are in the Congo. Rwanda has been an aggressor force against the Congolese people. And they've been saying this for years. That's on one side of the ledger in the words that they've articulated as diplomats. But there hasn't been any actions. There hasn't been any sanctions. There hasn't been any military aid being withheld from the Rwandan government. In fact, Rwanda has been rewarded in the midst of this past 3 years aggression where they've surrounded the city of Goma. The European Union has doled out €20 million in 2023, again in 2024 to the Rwandan government. In addition to that, the European Union has entered into a critical minerals deal with the Rwandan government to get access to critical minerals. And as the Rwandan forces, the UN said there are about 4,000 forces in the Congo, and the M23 captured territory. They captured the largest coltan mine in the Congo, in Rubayo. Rwanda is listed as the number one producer of coltan in the world. So here it is that it's clearly evident that minerals are being smuggled out of Congo through Rwanda into the international market, and Rwanda is being rewarded for its aggression against the Congolese people, which, as you laid out in the introduction, the humanitarian outfall is catastrophic for the people. I was in the displacement camps a few months ago, and people are living in bestial condition. What we see unfolding in the Congo is really a scar on the conscience of humanity, and it's unnecessary, right?
Maurice,
it's absolutely unnecessary. So the international community can do. Yes.
Maurice Carney, I wanted to ask you, first of all, the significance of the apparent seizure of at least parts or all of Goma, a city of more than 3 million people, bigger than the city of Chicago, suddenly falling under the military forces of Rwanda.
It's important, one, to remind your viewing audience that this is not the first time this has happened. In 2012, Rwanda, back in the M23 and having its forces in the Congo, they seized Goma At that time, what President Obama did, he called Paul Kagame on the phone and told him basically back off. But in addition to that, he withheld military aid. That's what the United States did. Not a lot, $200,000. However, what that did is it showed some kind of leadership. And then the European nations followed suit and withheld tens of millions of dollars. In addition to that, the UN strengthened its mandate where it called for a force intervention brigade, where South Africa and Malawi and Tanzania all went in to confront the Rwandan forces and their M23. So this is the one point. It's not the first time this has happened. So we see Paul Kagame being a repeat offender. And with his capturing the city of Goma, or attempting to capture the city of Goma, we had a message from one of our partners on the ground this morning. And basically said that, you know, I hear gunfire, there are bullets coming through my door. I can't go outside. I have to take cover. Right. Even before that, women that we work with in one of the largest displacement camps called Bulengo, they had been displaced from the occupation of their villages by the M23 and Rwandan forces, and then displaced right around Goma, and then they're being bombed again. So they had to go in the city. So we really have a catastrophic humanitarian situation unfolding, especially in a tightly knit area as Goma. One high-level official shared with us, you know, that the only place we have left to go is in the lake, right? So the people are trapped in a war that is unnecessary, a war that has been able to continue and be perpetuated because of the lack of action on the part of Western nations, and also because of the rewarding of Paul Kagame in spite of the war crimes, crimes against humanity, mass atrocities that he's committed. Even a 2010 UN report says that if the Rwandan soldiers, the UN mapping exercise report that came out in 2010, said if Rwandan soldiers are brought to book, you know, to justice, a competent court could try them for crimes of genocide in the Congo. There's just this lack of accountability. This rampant impunity, lack of justice, has enabled this to continue to this day. And we have an opportunity right now to bring an end to that.
As we wrap up, Maurice Carney, the UN peacekeeping mission has been there, what, since 1999, comprising 10,000 troops. In the last 2 days, two peacekeepers from South Africa, one from Uruguay, were killed, 11 injured. Can you talk about the significance of this and what you want to see happen as the UN calls Security Council meetings around the DRC?
Yes, UN peacekeepers are there with the South African troops, the Congolese troops. In fact, 9 South Africans have lost their lives. 3 Malawians have lost their lives. What is interesting, Amy, Rwanda is the largest contributor to peacekeepers, to the UN peacekeeping efforts in Africa. Yet, in the Congo, they're firing surface-to-air missiles at the UN. So that they're at war against the United Nations. So really what needs to happen is a stronger action on the part of the Western nations. They can do that. 40% of Rwanda's budget comes from the West. Congo is so critical. It's a vital country to Africa, but to the world at large. It's a part of the second largest rainforest in the world, sequesters more carbon than all the tropical rainforests combined. Therefore, it's vital in combating the climate crisis. And at the same time, it's indispensable to the green energy transition, producing 70% of the world's cobalt. Cobalt is a central ingredient that's necessary for the batteries that power the electric vehicles and the green transition. So Congo is at the nexus of 2 major global phenomena, combating the climate crisis, making a green energy transition. So it's of interest to all of us to be engaged, to raise awareness, to hold our leaders accountable. So we should be calling on the UN to do more, calling on the European Union to cancel its contracts with Rwanda, calling on France. We hear France, Emmanuel Macron, has been blocking action, calling on Macron to stop blocking actions. So Congolese are demonstrating in Kinshasa. They're demonstrating today at the UN. We'll be demonstrating at the Rwandan embassy this coming weekend on Saturday. So people have to raise their voices, demonstrate, hold their leaders accountable, write letters, do everything that they can to assure that there's an immediate ceasefire, that Rwanda withdraws its troops from the Congo, the M23 demobilizes, and Congo restores the integrity of its state. It's almost right now, Rwanda and the M23 occupy in Congo almost land area almost the size of Rwanda itself.
Maurice Carney, we want to thank you for being with us, co-founder and executive director of Friends of the Congo, joining us from Mexico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Sudan. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres renewed his call for an immediate halt to the fighting between the Sudanese military and paramilitary rapid support forces. Guterres also condemned last week's drone attack on the last functioning hospital in the besieged city of El Fasher in North Darfur. The attack killed an estimated 70 people. Sudan's government blamed the RSF for the massacre. Over 14 million people have been displaced by the war in Sudan, which started in April of 2023. 3 million of those have become refugees, most of them crossing the border to South Sudan and Chad. We go now to Declan Walsh, chief Africa correspondent for The New York Times, based in Nairobi, Kenya. Last month, he wrote a piece headlined, "The Gold Rush at the Heart of a Civil War." Declan, thanks so much for being with us. Explain why gold is so essential to what the U.S. is now in Sudan calling a genocide, even.
Thanks, Amy. It's great to be with you. Look, it's really the most astonishing thing in this huge war. You know, the war has been going on for 2 years. It has destroyed the country, pushed it into famine. It has just absolutely crushed the economy. And yet the one thing that is still functioning, in fact, the one business that's still thriving, is gold. Sudan has some of the richest gold deposits in Africa. And since the war has started, our reporting showed that both sides have stepped up their efforts to exploit that gold, most of which ends up being traded in the United Arab Emirates and the Gulf. And they're using that funding for to fund the weapons purchases that are being used to fight the war.
And Declan, could you talk about the role of the United Arab Emirates in this conflict?
So one of the aspects of this conflict that have really bedeviled efforts to try and bring the two warring sides to peace is the fact that so many foreign countries have gotten involved on both sides. Far and away, the most significant meddlesome foreign power, if you like, is the United Arab Emirates. Our reporting and reporting by other outlets has shown that they have been smuggling weapons across the border into Sudan to the Rapid Support Forces. That's the paramilitary group that the U.S. has now determined committed genocide during the war. They've been smuggling those weapons for about the last 18 months. And it's become, certainly in the last months of the Biden administration, it had become quite a sensitive point between the two countries. Biden administration officials up to Vice President Harris had raised this issue in private with the Emiratis, asking them to stop the support for the RSF. There's a certain degree of support in Congress. Some lawmakers have introduced laws, or had it proposed laws, rather, suggesting that the U.S. should condition weapons sales to the Emirates so that it would stop supporting the RSF. But in public, the Biden administration was actually, I would say, much more supportive of the Emiratis. The Emiratis, of course, is an incredibly wealthy country with a lot of money to invest. It buys a lot of American weapons. And so that support has continued. Just last Friday, as news was coming through of the drone strike that you referenced in the introduction there, that killed about 70 people at a hospital in Darfur, we had a word from some lawmakers in Washington who said that they had been informed officially by the Biden administration that despite the promises by the Emiratis that they would stop funding or arming the RSF, that arming continues to this day.
And what is the reason, the purpose of the Emiratis in their support of the RSF?
Well, it should be said the Emiratis absolutely deny that they've consistently denied that they provide any support to the RSF. But as we know, you know, Sudan is a country with immense natural resources, not just gold, but it also has huge amounts, huge, immense agricultural potential, a lot of agricultural land along the Nile that is coveted or desirable to many Gulf countries that are facing a future where their own food security could be in doubt. But it's also a very strategic place. It has a long coastline along the Red Sea. And there are many countries that are jostling in the hope, including Russia, that hope that they may at some point be able to set up a port along that. And frankly, the other reason is just because the Emirates can. They have the Emirates has a long-standing relationship with the Rapid Support Forces and with its leader, General Mohammed Hamdan, that goes back to the campaign that the UAE waged along with Saudi Arabia in Yemen some years ago. As part of that campaign, the Emirates paid for the Rapid Support Forces to send some of its troops to Yemen to fight alongside its own forces. And so there's this long-standing relationship between some of these, the leaders of the Emirates, effectively members of their royal family, and the RSF. And the Emirates appears to have taken a calculation that they thought that he could win this war. But increasingly, the RSF has been losing ground on the battlefield, and there's a real question mark over whether, I mean, there's a question mark, frankly, over whether either side can win this war by purely military means.
And Declan Walsh, as we wrap up, I wanted to take us on the journey that you begin the gold rush at the heart of a civil war piece with. You say the luxury jet touched down in Juba, the capital of South Sudan, on a mission to collect hundreds of pounds of illicit gold. On board was a representative of a ruthless paramilitary group accused of ethnic cleansing in Sudan's sprawling civil war. The flight manifest showed the gold itself had been smuggled from Darfur, a region of famine and fear in Sudan that's largely under his group's brutal control. Take us from there to UAE, where the gold goes to, and the fact that you interviewed the head of the RSF, back in 2019 when they took over a gold mine and yet minimized its power, though ultimately it fueled the RSF to the power it is today.
Yeah, gold is really at the heart of the RSF's ascent to power. I mean, the RSF endeared itself to the autocratic ruler of Sudan, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, before he was overthrown in 2019. But it also grew incredibly rich by taking over the largest gold mine in the country and by using that money to build a business empire that extended into many businesses. And that's why when I met the leader of the RSF in 2019, I asked him about that. At the time, he tried to downplay it, but our reporting shows just how pervasive it's been. And the incident that you referred to that we reported on in the story was really just an effort to illustrate just one of many, many routes that gold follows when it flows out of Sudan. Sudan's a country that borders about seven other countries. Gold seems to be flowing across almost all of those borders into those countries, and sometimes through very circuitous smuggling routes involving a whole range of officials, not just in Sudan, but in neighboring countries, involving companies, gold traders in the UAE themselves. It ends up in the UAE, where, you know, research has showed about 90% of the gold from across Africa, including many conflict zones like Sudan, ultimately is traded.
Declan Walsh, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Chief Africa correspondent for The New York Times, based in Nairobi, Kenya. We'll link to your pieces on Sudan at democracynow.org, the gold rush at the heart of a civil war. Coming up, Holocaust survivors mark 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll speak to the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar, Raz Siegel. Stay with us. La 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 ni la ni le ya ya yo ani gu ni le. Adada Lullaby by the Sudanese musician Rasha. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Monday, Holocaust survivors and world leaders mark 80 years since the liberation of the Auschwitz Nazi death camp. Events were held in Poland as well as at the United Nations here in New York. This is Holocaust survivor Dumitru Mihalescu speaking at the United Nations yesterday. At 8 years old, he lost his mother, sister, and two of his brothers at Transnistria death camps.
Death was a daily presence. I saw my mother, my sister, and two of my brothers die. Only a few of us returned home. And when we did, we had nothing left.
A Roma survivor of the Holocaust. The commemoration came 2 days after the tech billionaire Elon Musk took a break from advising Donald Trump Saturday to give a surprise virtual address to the far-right AfD party, or Alternative for Germany. Musk's appearance came just days after he sparked controversy for twice giving a Nazi salute at a Trump inaugural event. Among other things, Musk told attendees it's time to move on from past guilt, an apparent reference to Nazism and the Holocaust, when he was talking to the AfD. For more, we're joined by the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar Raz Siegel, whose new article for Jacobin is headlined Genocide, Denial, and Holocaust Studies, Associate Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Sockton University, endowed professor in the study of modern genocide. Professor Siegel, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this day yesterday, the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the death camp Auschwitz, and how it relates to what's happening today.
Well, hello, Amy, and thanks for having me on the show again. I think that it was very significant to see a Roma survivor speak yesterday at the UN. I was there with students, but it was also shocking, actually, to see that the rest of the ceremony focused on, you know, what you might call a genocide-generating world of lies, because the main speaker in the ceremony yesterday was Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog, and he came on basically to present Palestinians as Nazis, to present Israel's attack on Palestinians in the frame, basically, of, as he described it himself, the Jewish state defending itself from this ongoing attack, right? Nazis in the past, Palestinians today, rather than the reality, which is a stateless population, Palestinians under decades of Israeli settler colonial rule, under siege, now under genocide in Gaza, and attacked by a very powerful state backed by all the Western powers. And this is a person, of course, Yitzhak Herzog, that back in October 2023 defined all Palestinians in Gaza, as we remember, as responsible for the Hamas attack on Israel, that is his enemies. In December 2023, he went on to talk about civilization and barbarism, that is Palestinians and barbarians, and Israel is part of a civilized world. He repeated this discourse yesterday. So it was very shocking to see, you know, on International Holocaust Remembrance Day, the UN, which we have to remember and remind everyone, right? Israel has killed now over 330 aid workers in this attack, the majority of them UN workers, right? So the institute that Israel has killed so many of its employees, we see this, again, what I call genocide-generating world of lies, right? A world turned upside down where people facing genocide become Nazis, become anti-Semites, and this is all a grotesque, again, display of lies. So this is what happened in the UN. It's important to say that the Roma survivor, which was, again, very remarkable to see, his message was that actually Roma continue to face attacks today, as they do in states across Europe, also states that are committed allegedly to Holocaust memory. They continue to face persecution and discrimination. And he called, actually, called out, and he said, you know, help us, you know, end this endless persecution that Roma continue to face still today, right? So he was also talking about the failure of what we call Holocaust memory in education. But then we saw it really in a grotesque way in display with Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog in attendance.
And Raz Siegel, could you talk about, in your Jacobin article, you've described the partnership between Israeli and German Holocaust scholars as troubling. Can you explain how this partnership perpetuates the denial of Israel's genocide in Gaza?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the field of Holocaust studies has always been based just the study of the Holocaust itself. And we have also genocide studies, or what we call Holocaust and genocide studies. But Holocaust studies was also always based on the idea that the Holocaust is unique. And this also meant that Israel, the state of Holocaust survivors, or the state that portrays itself as a state of Holocaust survivors, the Jewish state, is also unique. And this is really at the basis of Nakba denial, right? The idea that Israel cannot perpetrate any crime under international law, let alone genocide. So this was very central also in Holocaust studies always, this kind of protection for Israel from criticism and really the perpetuation of Nakba denial, the denial, right, of the ongoing Nakba as well, the continued assault on Palestinians. And this is what we see today. This is the reason that since October 2023, right, so many Holocaust scholars have actually gone out of their way to protect Israel, to attack other Holocaust and genocide scholars like myself, including many Jews, including Israelis who speak out about Israel's attack on Gaza, who speak on the basis of the mountain of evidence that we have today about Israel's attack on Gaza. But again, it's very grotesque that we see it among Holocaust scholars. I wrote this piece about an event that took place online organized by the Western Galil College in Israel, where there is a Holocaust program and a strong collaboration between Israeli and German Holocaust scholars. And the whole event was actually designed as an attack against Holocaust and genocide scholars like myself, who speak about Israel's attack on Gaza. We were portrayed as anti-Zionists and therefore anti-Semites, right? So this equation of anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, but there was also just crude genocide denial. One of the speakers, Verena Buster, for example, who's a German scholar in Berlin that teaches online in Israel in that program, outright said, minimizing the number of Palestinians killed by Israel, saying that there's no starvation. These kinds of outright crude denials that go against all the evidence that we have. But again, we see it in the frame of Holocaust studies now. And this is rooted in the history of this field, that it was always based, again, on the idea that Israel is a unique state, right? That Israel cannot perpetrate really any crime under international law, impunity for Israel and the international legal system, but also in this field. And therefore, we see this kind of denial reproduced today, and we saw it in this event that I wrote about.
Professor, I wanted to just end by asking you about what just happened at the American Historical Association. I saw you a few weeks ago here in New York at the Hilton when members of the group voted overwhelmingly, 428-88, to oppose Scholasticide in Gaza. If you can talk about what happened next. I was talking to a past president of the American Historical Association. They said, oh, I'm sure they're going to have to go along with that vote because it was so overwhelming. But they vetoed it. We have 20 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, the AHA Council unfortunately vetoed this vote. Of course, this is, you know, an insistence on defending Israel at all costs. I think that what we're seeing, of course, is U.S. institutions standing behind the defense of Israel, because if we come to terms with what Israel is doing, which is Israeli settler colonialism, this then means that the settler colonial genie is out of the bottle. We have to talk also about settler colonialism here in the U.S.,
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. Professor Raz Siegel, Israeli-American historian, expert in Holocaust studies. We'll link to your Jacobin piece. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca. Find us on social media and please support our vital work through our website.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.